Chuck Lutz, and we've been asked to say a little bit about our background and experience with the subject matter we're discussing in these sessions. So I'll just tell you that my involvement with the Holy Land situation, I think, began, well, it really came to flower back in 89 when our pastor at that time, Don Luther at Lutheran Church of Christ the Redeemer in Minneapolis, returned from a sabbatical that he had had at Tontour, which is a Vatican-sponsored ecumenical study center on the border between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And while there, Don had gotten to know the people at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, and he came back and asked our congregation if we'd like to form an ongoing relationship, kind of sister parish relationship with Christmas Lutheran, and we said yes. And ever since, we've had that relationship with visits both directions and with a number of other involvements. Our congregation took on the task of raising money to rebuild the pipe organ at Christmas Lutheran back in the year 2000. It had been, as with all of the Lutheran work in the Holy Land, the congregation had been formed through the efforts of German Lutheran missionaries in the 19th century, and the pipe organ was built in Berlin in the 1890s, and it was in total disrepair. It wasn't usable. So we raised money to have an organ builder go and check it out, dismantle it, bring it back to Minnesota, where it was completely rebuilt and reinstalled and used for Christmas Eve worship on at Christmas Eve in the year 2000. So that's been a part of my history. I've also led groups on pilgrimage visits 5 times to the Holy Land. And in the last decade, I've been involved as the grassroots organizer in Minnesota for a coalition of Washington-based church agencies called Churches for Middle East Peace, which basically does advocacy, lobbying with members of Congress across the country on U.S. policy regarding the Middle East. And so that's my background. I also, a few years ago, co-authored a book that I'll be using some in our presentations this week, called Christians in a Land Called Holy with Robert Smith. Robert is now the ELCA desk person in Chicago in Global Mission for the Middle East. Relates to the Middle East and the churches there and the work of the churches there. The book is available in the bookstore if you wish to acquire a copy. I think they're selling it for $15. And if you have a copy that you'd like to have me autograph, I'll do that for no extra charge. So today what we're going to talk about is the facts on the ground. Where are we in the search for peace? Where are they? Where is the world community in the search for peace between Israelis and Palestinians? And to talk about that, I'm going to do a very quick review of the last century, because you really have to go back to the time toward the close of World War I, when the League of Nations, following World War I, gave to the Brits the responsibility for running a territory, the former Palestinian territory under the Ottoman Empire, as a mandate. And that happened in other parts of the Middle East, with the French having mandate territories as well as the Brits. But we'll come from then down to the present in terms of where we are in the quest for peace, which has been very elusive, as I'm sure you know. To begin, I'm going to read another prayer. The leadership initiative, the interreligious leadership initiative for peace, which is really staffed by a Seattle resident, Ron Young. He's based here in Seattle, but Ron has, with church leaders in the U.S., with interfaith leaders actually, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, put together a number of efforts in the, what they call the inter-religious initiative for peace. Mark Hansen of the ELCA, presiding bishop, is part of that. But one of the things they've done is that they've gathered prayers and liturgical material from all three faith traditions to make available for use in congregations and elsewhere. And I'm going to invite us today to join in the prayer that was authored by an imam, a Muslim imam in Tampa, Florida, named Abdel Wahab Hekish. Well, let us pray. Almighty God, after almost a century of mistrust and fratricide, you inspire Jews, Christians, and Muslims to take the path of reconciliation in the Middle East. We ask for your forgiveness, O God, yet we find it hard to forgive those who are past enemies. May your words touch those who still stray in the wilderness of vengeful violence, forgetting your command to forgive and overlook till God accomplish his purpose. For God hath power over all things. Amen. Okay, the facts on the ground. How did we get to where we are today? The breakup of the Ottoman Empire, which had been running things in that part of the world for 400 years. I think it's interesting, at least for Lutherans, to note that the beginning of the Ottoman rule in that part of the world was in 1517, the year that is usually credited with being the launching time of the Reformation. Luther's posting of the 95 Theses on the church door in Wittenberg and what followed. So from 1517 to 1917, the Ottoman Turks were running things there, and they had pretty good, relations with the minority Christians and the few Jews who were still living in that area at the time. In that same year, 1917, as World War I was still closing down, it was still going on, the Balfour Declaration was issued in the United Kingdom. Balfour was a foreign minister in the cabinet of the British government at that time, and the Balfour Declaration said in November 1917, that the government viewed with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. It was a kind of response to the Zionist ideology, the Zionist movement, which was sweeping across Europe at that time. And it said that the government of the Brits viewed with favor the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people. Zionist movement under Herzl had called for the establishment of a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state. But the Balfour Declaration had a second part to it that is often forgotten. It qualified its call for a Jewish homeland with these words: "It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." So that's the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration is considered historically significant because it was the first expression from one of the great powers of Europe about the establishment of a Jewish homeland. A couple years later, the League of Nations was formed, and one of its responsibilities, as the League saw it, was to decide what to do with the territories that had been part of the Ottoman Empire, not only the Ottoman Empire, but other parts of the world as well. But after World War I, what to do with some of the former colonies in Europe or in Africa and in the Middle East? And the League set up a mandate system in which some of the great powers were given responsibility for governing territories and to lead toward self-rule, toward independence, the peoples who were there. And many of those were in the Middle East. What is today Iraq? What is today Jordan? And certainly the Palestinian the territory of Palestine. And the Brits were given responsibility for that. The French, I think, had responsibility for Lebanon and Syria. The Brits also had Jordan and Iraq. So the Brits were running things in Palestine from 1919 until 1948. During that period, scattered communities of Jews were returning, were coming back to that land. There had always been a few living there through the Ottoman period, but now larger numbers came. And they were basically buying land. Mostly they were welcomed by the Palestinians, it appears. They were not viewed with hostility. But some Palestinians became very critical of other Palestinians who sold land to the Jews. So that was going on. There was some division within the Palestinian community. There were about, by the time of the British, or the time of the end of the mandate, the time that the State of Israel was established, it is estimated there were about 1 million Palestinians. And by that time there were still fewer than 1 million Jews, but shortly after the establishment of the State of Israel, larger numbers of Jews came. Both the Jews and the Palestinians during the British Mandate period tended to see the Brits as occupiers and as foreigners and as a foreign force, and they wanted them to depart. The mandate ended when the UN acted after World War II. In November of 1947, and all of this at this point was a kind of global community reaction to the Holocaust, to the what happened to the Jews under the Hitler period. In November of 1947, the United Nations declared that Mandate Palestine should be partitioned into a State of Israel, or what should become a State of Israel, and what was to be a Palestinian state. It was divided roughly, I've got some maps here that some of you may not have received the other night when we passed them around, so if you don't have it, feel free to take one. The Palestinian mandate territory was divided about 55% for a Jewish homeland and 45% for what was to become a Palestinian state, which of course we're still waiting for. That has never happened. In May of 1948, Israel was established through a declaration by the Israeli Jewish people of a state of statehood. Immediately, the Arab nations surrounding the new state of Israel went to war. They opposed it. They took issue with its establishment. They were opposed to any kind of Jewish homeland being there. And in the war that followed, the fighting that followed, Israel accomplished the acquisition of another 20 to 25% of the land, so that by the end of the war, by the time of the armistice after that war in 48, 78% of Mandate Palestine was Israel, and 22% was Palestinian territory. The Palestinian territory was under the governance in the West Bank and East Jerusalem of the Kingdom of Jordan from 48 for almost 20 years. Gaza, over on the Mediterranean Sea, was under the governance of Egypt. Of the 1 million Arabs in Israel, when Israel was established, when the
the end of the war, and in 1948, the million Arabs in Israel, about 300,000, stayed and continued living in Israel proper, and they and their descendants are there to this day. Today they number about 1.25 million. But they became citizens of Israel. About 700,000 of the million Arabs in the Israeli territory left. They fled or they were forced out, some of each. Now they number about 4 million, they and their children and their grandchildren. About 4 million are officially classified under international law as refugees. A refugee is someone who, because of a conflict, has to flee or is forced out of his homeland, his or her homeland, and under international law has a right to return. So one of the issues in any peace negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis is what to do with the 4 million Palestinian refugees. Are they entitled to go back to their family homeland in Israel proper? Israel, of course, says no, because if that were to happen, Israel would no longer have a majority of Jews. The majority of the population of Israel would be non-Jews. So that's one of the issues that has to be dealt with. How do you deal with the refugee situation? The refugees, since 1948, have been under the care of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, which is responsible on behalf of the world community for providing housing, food, education, all things that are necessary for living to the Palestinian refugees. They are in camps in Gaza. In fact, Gaza's population of about 1.5 million is two-thirds to three-fourths refugees. Some of them are in the West Bank. Some of them, there's a refugee camp in Bethlehem that I've visited. There are some in Jordan, across the Jordan River on the east side. There are some in Lebanon. They're scattered all around. And some of them are now living in the United States. They have traveled to the U.S. and settled here. But most of them are still in the Middle East. So what to do with the refugees that resulted from the 1948 conflict is a major agenda item for any peace conversation, any peace resolution. 1967, the Six-Day War in June of 67, Israel defeats the Arab armies that were arrayed against it, and takes over the territory of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, and becomes an occupying power. Almost immediately, Israel starts to settle civilian Jews in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, some also in Gaza. But under international law governing military occupation of one people by another, it is spelled out very clearly that it is against the law for an occupying power to settle its own civilian population on occupied land. So all of the growth of settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are viewed under international law as illegal. The Israeli official position is it's not a breaking of the law because the territory they occupied was not independent nation. It was territory. It is territory that is not sovereign, a sovereign nation. Today there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers, on occupied land. There are no longer any in Gaza because about five years ago, I think it was, under Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel, the 8,000 Israelis settled in Gaza were removed, and most of them were moved to the West Bank, to settlements there. And so there is no longer immediately in Gaza any Jewish presence. There is no Israeli military there. There are no Israeli settlers there. But Israel still completely controls Gaza. They surround it. They control all access to it by land, by sea, by air. You may remember recently reading about the flotilla of aid ships that were coming down from Turkey to get supplies into Gaza, trying to break the blockade. Israel has maintained a blockade of Gaza down to the present day, and they determine what can get in. They also determine who can get out. Let me just interrupt here with a personal story that I think was, I didn't realize at the time the significance of it, but as I look back on it, it's fascinating, and I write about it in the book. I was a staff member with the World Council of Churches U.S. office, U.S. Conference of the World Council, in 1969 in New York. And part of my responsibility was to deal with the U.S. church's relationship to the Jewish community. So Christian-Jewish relations was part of my job description. And I was visited, because I had that assignment, he was sent to me, by a young rabbi from Brooklyn, a rabbi whose name was Meir Kahani. Does that name ring a bell for any of you? Meir Kahani was a young rabbi in Brooklyn, and he came to see me, and he asked if the churches of the World Council, at least the churches in the United States of the World Council, would officially recognize Israel's right to all of the land, from the river to the sea, all of the occupied territory, if the churches would come out and make a statement to that effect, endorsing what was then seen as Greater Israel, the entire land from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. And I said, well, I don't think the churches of the World Council will be likely to make that kind of statement. Some conservative Christian bodies might be willing to do it, but they're not in the World Council of Churches. At that time, we didn't know about the reality of Christian Zionism, but there were, I think, some churches, some church people in the United States who would have gone along with what Meir Kahani was asking. But I told him I didn't think the World Council of Churches member churches would. So then he thanked me for the visit and left. And some years later, he wound up in Israel. He was elected to the parliament, the Knesset, and in 1974, which is 5 years later, he moved to Israel, and 10 years after that, he was elected to the Knesset. He and his party, Kach, K-A-C-H, pressed for an official policy on the part of the Israeli government of removing all Palestinians from both Israel proper and the occupied territories. He wanted to do ethnic cleansing in a major way. Kahani was killed at a New York City hotel while on a visit there in 1990. And the person who killed him, or was charged with killing him, was an Arab named El Said Nosair, N-O-S-A-I-R. He was charged with his murder, but he was acquitted. That same fellow, Nosair, in 1996, was sentenced to life in prison for his role in plans to bomb New York City sites, including the World Trade Center attack of 1993. Kahani's political party in Israel, Kach, was banned from civic participation by Israel in 1994, and later the U.S. State Department labeled it a terrorist organization. Today there is in the West Bank a Jewish settlement of about 1,000 Kahani followers. It's the community of Itamar, it's south and east of Nablus, if you know that geography. Near the Palestinian village of Yanun. The last time I was there, was in 2005, and I noticed bumper stickers on Israeli autos proclaiming, Rabbi Kahane lives, or Kahane was right. So there are some right-wing Israeli Jews who are still sympathetic to Kahane's program, his goal of ethnic cleansing and so forth. Peace efforts. Where have we been during this last 50, 60 years? After the Six-Day War, there was a UN Resolution 242, which is still often referred to as a basis for where we need to go in any peace process leading to a resolution of the conflict. UN Resolution 242, and this is one that the United States did not veto. We vetoed many resolutions as a Security Council, one of the five of the Security Council of a veto. Many of the resolutions dealing with the Israel-Palestine conflict we have vetoed, but this one we did not. We supported this as a country. In November of 1967, UN Resolution 242 called for withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict, that is in the June Six-Day War, termination of all claims or states of belligerency, and respect for and acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area, and their right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, free from threats or acts of force, and lastly, a just settlement of the refugee problem. So UN Resolution 242 is often returned to as a starting point for peace talks, peace negotiations. Next thing I want to run through with you quickly is the UN stance through nine different presidencies, down to the present one. Because it is significant, I think, that the United States is seen by most of the world, and has been for quite a while, as the key player in bringing about a peaceful resolution of the conflict. And we have had a role in some of the peace building in the area already under Jimmy Carter, 1979. The Camp David talks led to an agreement between Egypt and Israel to recognize each other and to be at peace. Later we had some role in the building of peace between Jordan and Israel, which was in 1994. Not as significant a role as Carter played in 79, but still we had some involvement in that. So where do we go, or where are we going under U.S. Administrations? Beginning with the Johnson administration. The Johnson administration said in 1964, Israel's government is aware of our continuing concern that nothing be done in the occupied areas which might prejudice the search for a peaceful settlement. Transfer of civilians to occupied areas, whether or not in settlements which are under military control, is contrary to Article 49 of the Geneva Convention. Under the Nixon administration, the application of Israeli law to occupied portions of Jerusalem is detrimental to our common interests in Jerusalem. That's East Jerusalem, reference to that, which is the Arabic part of Jerusalem, the Palestinian part. The pattern of behavior authorized under the General Convention, Geneva Convention, and international law is clear. The occupier must maintain the occupied areas as intact and unaltered as possible, without interfering with the customary life of the area. Under the Ford administration, substantial resettlement of the Israeli civilian population in occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, is illegal under the Geneva Convention. So repeatedly, there was a statement from the United States government to the world, and certainly to the state of Israel, that settlement activity is a no-no and should stop. And of course, it has never stopped. Under the Carter administration. Jimmy Carter, as I said, was the first president to make direct personal efforts toward peace between Israel and its neighbors. And it's out of that Camp David agreement in 1979 that came the practice of U.S. aid to Israel in the amount of an average of $3 billion a year. Ever since 1979, we, the U.S. taxpayers, have been providing at least, it's now over $100 billion total in aid. And most of it is in the form of military aid. And, of course, Israel has to buy the weapons that we're, I mean, they have to acquire the weapons that we're providing from U.S. providers. U.S. arms industry benefits from it. And one reason it's hard to get that repealed or ended or even scaled down is the interest of the U.S. arms industry in making profit from the distribution of weapons to Israel. The Reagan administration, September of 82, further settlement activity is in no way necessary for the security of Israel and only diminishes the confidence of the Arabs that a final outcome can be free and fairly negotiated. During the George the First Bush administration, my position is, said President Bush, H.W. Bush, my position is that the foreign policy of the United States says we do not believe there should be new settlements in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem, and I will conduct that policy as if it's firm, which it is. The Clinton administration. Bill Clinton was the second U.S. president after Carter to take an active personal role in seeking Israeli-Palestinian peace. His involvement with the Oslo Accords, these were rather secret talks between Arafat and Rabin, Israelis and Palestinian Israelis, in Oslo, Norway, that led to an appearance on the White House lawn in 1993, and set the pattern for some administration of the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority, rather limited because it's still under the overall control of Israel, but charted out a course to be followed to get to what eventually would be a Palestinian state and an Israeli state living side by side in peace. Clinton was therefore involved all the way through his 8 years, the Oslo Accords, and then the Camp David negotiations toward the end of his administration. The reports are that they came very close to a final agreement, but in the end failed. And as I said, the Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty of 94 also came during the Clinton era. Next to finally, the George W. Bush administration. George W. Bush in 2002 said the Israeli settlement activity in occupied territories must stop, and the occupation must end through withdrawal to secure and recognized boundaries consistent with UN Resolution 242. In April of 2003, George W. Bush initiated the development of the so-called roadmap. The roadmap was endorsed by the quartet. The quartet is Russia, the European Union, the United Nations Security Council, and the US. And the quartet's roadmap, again, called for movement toward final status negotiations on all of the key issues that would lead to an independent Palestine living in peace with Israel. But then later in the Bush administration, Bush openly endorsed new policies pushed by the Israeli government, including expansion of the settlements. And George W. Bush liked to say that, a final agreement has to take into consideration the facts on the ground, by which he meant basically the fact that there are a 500,000 Israelis living on Palestinian territory. Obama very soon after inauguration, I think the very next day, Obama made phone calls to both the Israeli government leader Netanyahu and to Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader. And he then said he was going to name as a special envoy to work on getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to sit down and talk to each other and work out a final agreement. And he did. He named Senator George Mitchell, who is still in that special role. It is not clear if anything is happening. There are indirect talks going on. Mitchell and his people talk one day with the Palestinians and another day with the Israelis, but the Israelis and Palestinians aren't talking directly, face-to-face yet. The hope is that they'll get to that point eventually, but so far they have not. The continuing issue of settlements has also been a part of the conversation since the Obama administration took office. The Obama administration has called for an end to settlements, but it wasn't until early this year, 2010, that Netanyahu said, we'll put a moratorium on settlements for 8 months in the West Bank, but never agreed to end settlements and end Judaizing of East Jerusalem. So that's about where we are in terms of peace process. We'll spend all of tomorrow on where are we going in terms of U.S. policy and U.S. pressure and U.S. leadership in that, and what is the role of U.S. citizens, and particularly in the churches, in helping to facilitate that process moving along. But the situation on the ground right now is that there are 500,000 Israelis in West Bank and East Jerusalem settlements. There are checkpoints all over the West Bank. You can't move from one Palestinian area to another without going through Israeli military checkpoints. There are bypass roads all over the West Bank that only Israelis can use. Palestinians can't use roads in their own territory that are built and available, but they can't use them. There was an intifada, the first intifada in 1987. Intifada is Arabic for uprising. It's usually translated. That was mostly nonviolent. It was things like tax resistance and refusing to cooperate with the Israeli military and civil authority in the West Bank, but pretty much a nonviolent uprising. The second intifada broke out in the year 2000, and that was more violent. That's when we had the experience of the suicide bombers that you remember. And as a result of that violence, Israel started building a separation wall, not on the border between Palestinian territory and Israel, but within Israel, within Palestinian territory, snaking around settlements that were there. And many have seen that as a Israeli land grab, trying to say that the future border will be basically where the wall is, so that the Israeli settlements will be on the Israeli side of the wall, and it will take more land away from the Palestinians. In the Palestinian society in the last decade or so, you've had developments such as the International Solidarity Movement. The International Solidarity Movement is a way that Palestinian civil society brings in, welcomes internationals to come and do things with Palestinian villagers. And I've been part of that, and we've had groups from Minnesota who've gone to work with Palestinians in olive harvesting in the fall. One time in 2002, Robert Smith and I were in the same group. My co-author here, he and I were part of a group that joined villagers in the north of the West Bank in demonstrating against the siting of the wall. That's when it was starting to be built in the north of the West Bank. And we went out with villagers and protested, stood in front of bulldozers that were clearing the path for it. And in fact, one of our group was arrested because when he was ordered to disperse, we were ordered to disperse by the Israeli military, he stood there and stayed there and with villagers and was arrested. And he was put in an Israeli prison for 4 days, and then he was released through the efforts of the United States embassy, and he was told to go home. He was, in effect, deported. So he, in fact, he came, he was a Methodist minister who came from Washington State down in the Yakima area. Can't remember his name, but anyway, the International Solidarity Movement continues that kind of work, bringing internationals in to work with Palestinian villagers in various causes, both working for human rights and in demonstrations that protest the Israeli government's behavior. What else? Israeli peace activism has been significant during this period. There are groups like Rabbis for Human Rights, which try to defend against the behavior of their own government the rights of Palestinians. ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, works to stop, if it can, the Israeli government from demolishing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. They usually don't succeed, so then they help the Palestinians to rebuild. It's headed by a person who's become a good friend of mine, a native Minnesotan, a Jew named Jeff Helper, who grew up in Hibbing and went to McAllister College in St. Paul. Then he went to Israel and became an Israeli citizen and taught for some years in an Israeli university in anthropology. And Jeff is now heading the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He often comes back to Minnesota to speak and to raise money. And he was there most recently for the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly, which met in Minneapolis in early July. And Jeff was there basically as a resource person to the Presbyterians on what to say and what actions to take on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You've got groups like B'Tselem, which is an Israeli Jewish human rights organization that documents violations of human rights throughout the Palestinian territories by the Israeli government. Women in Black, another group, every Friday noon, they appear with internationals who want to join with them on the streets of West Jerusalem to protest the behavior of the Israeli government in particular ways and to be a kind of statement of solidarity with the Palestinians. There's also been an increase in the international presence for peace in the region. The Christian peacemaker teams have been very active in Hebron for many years. The ecumenical accompaniment program in Palestine and Israel, which is a World Council of Churches organized effort working with the local churches, the indigenous churches in Palestine, to bring people typically for a three-month period to work with Palestinian institutions. Many of the folks that I'm aware of who've done that have worked with Lutheran schools and Lutheran congregations in Palestine. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has a program that is called Young Adults in Global Mission. It sends people for a year to work there. And one who was part of that this past year is Greta Stieber, who I think was here last week. I saw her on the list of, I think she did a presentation on her experience. And there are others that are coming, largely through the work of the churches worldwide, to be a presence for peace and to work on issues of human rights. And then you have the ongoing work of the churches, the international church community, with the indigenous churches in diakonia, in education, in medicine. And that's been true for many centuries, but it's flowering today. So you have, for example, the Lutherans operating a hospital on the Mount of Olives, Augusta Victoria Hospital, which is the only place for specialized medical care in cancer treatment and some other areas for all of the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. let me stop there and just say again that tomorrow we'll talk about political advocacy in the United States for Holy Land peace and how we can help to shape U.S. government policies. Yes?
Could you comment on what languages are being used and how opposing sides, what if there's a common language they use when they speak to each other?
Israelis and Palestinians?
Yes.
I think in the formal peace talks over the years, they have probably used Hebrew and Arabic with interpreters. But it's also true that a lot of Palestinians understand Hebrew and a lot of Israelis understand Arabic. So they're also able to use the language. In much of the work that civil society work that I've talked about, the common language is English. Almost all Israelis and almost all Palestinians that I've had any contact with have English. They all know English. And the Palestinians in their schools learn English, and I think probably the Israelis in their Hebrew schools, in their schools, learn English as well. So English is really a universal language there, as well as in most of the world these days. Yeah.
Chuck, up here.
Yes?
Okay, that's like the world's stupidest question, but why is it that, tell a little bit about the history of U.S. aid to Israel and why we have so little power when we give them so much. Why we have so little power to negotiate or to get them to negotiate when we give them so much money.
Yeah. That's a very good question, because there are many who believe that the most important thing the United States government could do to get Israel to move toward a final peace agreement is to cut off our aid, is to pull back those dollars, or at least reduce them. The fact is that it's almost impossible even to get that talked about in the U.S. Congress.
Because of AIPAC or because of...
Yeah, that's part of it. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is the primary U.S. Jewish lobby on this agenda, and they have a great deal of influence. But I've been told by my former member of the U.S. House, Marty Sabol, in Minneapolis, who was there, I think, for 18 years, that he, when he was in office, got more communication on the Israel-Palestine issue from, and more pressure from U.S. Christian Zionists than he did from U.S. Jews. He said they were more rabid and they were more insistent and more right-wing, more conservative, more determined not to have anything done that would express a judgment of Israel's behavior. My current House member is Keith Ellison, who is a Muslim, the first Muslim elected to the U.S. Congress. And Keith, who has really made quite a bit of the Israel-Palestine issue, he's a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he's really made he's made a number of visits there. He and Brian Baird from Washington State, down in the, I think, in the Tacoma area, visited Gaza shortly after the Gaza incursion in 2009. And they were the first U.S. government persons to go to Gaza in 3 years. Brian Baird, by the way, is a former, I think, head of the psychology department at PLU, Pacific Lutheran University. Anyway, they went, and Keith says, when we talk with him on this agenda, he says, yes, keep pressing the issue of U.S. aid to Israel as a tool that should be used, you know, reducing U.S. aid to get the peace process going. But he said, don't expect me to speak out on it at this point, because he says it is so unpopular in the Congress to raise that issue in any open way, that if I speak out on that, I will lose whatever influence I have on other issues. So he says, I'm with you on it. I think we ought to do some changing in our aid to Israel. But he said, don't expect me to provide any vocal leadership on it for a while yet.
May I mention one sort of complicating factor relating to U.S. financial support for Israel? And you alluded in part to it before with the Camp David Accords,
yeah,
which is some of our commitment grows out of those accords. If we were part of the treaty, we also extend money, I wanted to just add, to Egypt.
Exactly.
We are substantial. I think between Egypt and Israel, it's almost a third of our
foreign aid.
Yeah. But those are sort of contractual treaty obligations. So we're not really at liberty to just, I don't know if all of the aid we give to Israel grows out of that directly, but certainly a substantial part of it does.
Yeah, that's true. It does come out of the Camp David Agreement of 1979, but my understanding is that it also needs to be renewed periodically. Mm-hmm. And so Congress could act not to renew or to adjust downward, you know.
Okay, yeah, and I don't remember the exact link.
Yeah.
That sort of led me to a related question that sort of grew out of this, which is, what's your sense, looking beyond or behind AIPAC, what's your sense of shifts in the Jewish American community and how they're both pushing Israel and pushing the United States?
Yeah, I will spend more time on that tomorrow when we talk about the U.S. activities from a variety of groups and sources in trying to influence U.S. policy. But one of the recent developments, just to give a quick answer, is the formation of a new group of primarily American Jews called J Street. Mm-hmm. J Street is an attempt to be a different voice than AIPAC, a more moderate voice, and they say their subtitle under J Street is pro-Israel and pro-peace. And their contention is that AIPAC, which also claims to be pro-Israel, is not really pro-peace. But J Street says we are for and they are very openly in favor of a two-state settlement. They are in favor of a sharing of Jerusalem. They're in favor of resolving those issues in a way that is closer to what the world community has been expressing and hoping for. And I would say more of a balanced approach to the Palestinians and the Israelis on U.S. in terms of U.S. policy. J Street is an interesting name. In Washington, a lot of the lobbies are located on K Street. And there is no J Street in the Washington grid pattern. And so this group has taken the name J Street. J, of course, suggesting Jewish. And also suggesting that they're a lobby. But yeah, you have that development. I think the other interesting thing that is related to your question is that the American Jewish community has an increasingly broad spectrum of political viewpoints on the Israel-Palestine conflict. It is not of one mind. There is a group called Jewish Voice for Peace that is very actively supporting not only a two-state resolution of the conflict, but even in support of such things as divestment and economic sanctions against Israel, which was unheard of in the American Jewish community in years past. So it's wrong to assume that all American Jews are at the same point on this issue, just as it's wrong to assume that all American Christians are at the same point. Others, yeah.
More facts on the ground. If you could comment on two areas. One is the demographics of what the relative populations are,
yes,
and birth rates and things like,
yeah,
that, and where,
yeah,
that might feed into all this. And the other is infrastructure and resources, like water resources or power and things like that, and how that plays out and,
yeah,
creates tensions and pressures and dynamics in this whole puzzle.
Yeah, on the latter point, the control not only of the land and the people, but of all the resources from the river to the sea is entirely under the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. so that even water that is under the land that Palestinians live on is controlled, the aquifer, the water that comes up through the wells, and as well as the water from the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee and surface water, all of it is controlled by a state of Israel. And Palestinians, in effect, have to beg and buy to get their own water back through Israel. And they do, but they have to acquire it. They have to negotiate for it. The studies have shown that the Israeli settlers in the West Bank use per capita 10 times as much water annually as the Palestinians use. And that's partly because they have swimming pools, they have water available for irrigating, they have water available for watering their golf courses. The distribution of that resource is very unfair. The other question, the demographics. And that's really become a major issue in any kind of peace negotiations. The total population of what would be called the Holy Land, the area from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, what was Mandate Palestine, the total population is about 11 million today. And it's almost 50-50, Jewish and Palestinian or Arab. And the growth is greater among the non-Jewish population. And so if all of the people in that territory, that area, were to become a single sovereign nation, very soon it would be a non-Jewish majority, if it isn't already. And so the interest of Israel in maintaining itself as a Jewish state, the majority Jewish state, there's even some concern among the population of Israel proper, which is about 6 million, and 20% of it is non-Jewish. And that percentage continues to go up because they're having babies faster than the Jewish population. But at this point, it's still about 80% Jewish and 20% non-Jewish in Israel proper. But if you put all of the people together under one unit, under one government, you'd have a non-Jewish majority, and so I think that's probably one of the main reasons why the Jews do not want to have a single state with equal citizenship rights for everybody who's there, because they would lose their status as a Jewish majority nation.
Is it also true that there are young people, Israeli and Palestinians, who meet and work together and
yes.
are trying to find solutions for the future?
Yes, yes. There is also a very interesting group that is called the Company of the Bereaved. Parents or family members, but usually it's parents of children who've been lost or young people who've been lost because of the violence. Both Israeli Jews and Palestinian parents, families of the bereaved, who go and speak not only in Israel and Palestine about their experience, and they say that their ability to give meaning to the loss of their children is related to their working for peace out of their experience and calling for an end to violence and for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. They also send groups around the world to talk. They've been in Minneapolis. I've heard them there. So that's another example of Palestinians and Israelis working together for peace out of an experience of unpeace and of great violence that they've experienced personally. Yes?
As you know, one of the major sticking points has been the right of return
yeah.
for the Palestinians. What's the consensus position on the from the groups that you're working with on that contentious issue?
Most of the observers who are not personally involved, in the international community and even I think in U.S. government,
who have spoken on that say that they believe the solution, a just solution of the refugee right of return issue, is not literally for any large number of refugees to go back to Israel proper, but to have some kind of a compensation program, a just compensation for what they lost, coming from basically the world community, not coming from Israeli treasury, but from some kind of international aid package that is set up to address their loss and to compensate them for what they lost in terms of homes and property and so forth. And I think that's probably where, if it ever is resolved, I think that's where it's going to go.
You have a sense that the Palestinians could live with that?
I think so, yeah.
There's a question here. We're just going to comment on the family circle, the bereaved.
The bereaved, yeah.
When the ELCA bishops and the ELCIC bishops were there, we met with two families, two gentlemen. One of the comments they said is important for us to note that we are sharing our pain, not comparing our pain.
Uh-huh.
And that it is that sense of how both sides are in pain and accepting that as opposed to we hurt worse and therefore we can retaliate.
Yeah.
That is a significant point that they bring to the discussion.
Yeah.
Can I tell
them
about this, the end of the organ story?
No, the pipe organ restoration for Christmas Lutheran. I think what she's referring to is when they got the pipe organ back to it came in through Israel, Israeli control through the as everything going to the West Bank does through the port of Haifa up in the Galilee, and the Israelis held on to it and wouldn't release it for movement to Bethlehem because they said they had to put an import duty on it. And they were asking for, I don't know, something like $10,000. And the organ builder, Roland Rutz, was there trying to get it freed and shipped to Bethlehem. And he said, that's not legitimate. And they said, well, yeah, it's a new instrument. And anything new, we put a duty on. And he said, no, it's not new. It's an old one that's been refurbished, rebuilt. And he said it has a few new parts, but most of it is not new. Most of it is from the 1890s in Germany. Well, they finally negotiated it down to, I think, $1,000 or $2,000. And we had to come up with that money to get the organ released. Well, then it got to Bethlehem, and it was being rebuilt for use on Christmas Eve 2000. And when they were trying to get it operating, they discovered that the power supply, well, power source, I don't know what you call it, but in a pipe organ, was burned out, wouldn't work. And the organ builder said to Mitri Rahev, the pastor, you know, I think a car battery might work. And so the pastor went and got the battery out of his car, and they hooked that up, and that powered the organ for Christmas Eve.
So is that organ in working order now?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
To what extent?
When you were there, Bishop, did you worship at Christmas Lutheran?
Yes, it's a gorgeous instrument.
And you heard it working, yeah.
Although in this wonderful Jewish or Palestinian church, there in German,
yes,
it is written
from the Psalm. Let my mouth show, open my lips, and let my mouth show. Yep. Declare your praise.
And the last version of that. Jesus, the Good Shepherd in Bethlehem, has Jesus wearing a German shepherd's hat.
Yeah, and all over the Lutheran churches in Palestine, you see German inscriptions because the Germans planted the church there, and it's you have a feeling if you've been to Germany as I have, that you're somewhere in Bavaria. The architectural structure feels German, and in the Bethlehem church, even the stained glass windows have German in them. And the only Arabic in the place is up in the dome. But you have a feeling you're in transplanted Germany. There was a hand up back here.
Yes. To what extent does Israel frustrate the economy of the West Bank?
Yeah.
Well, in many respects, you'd have to say they're in complete control of it. They determine pretty much what gets in, what comes out in terms of trade, in terms of produce. They limit certain things from getting in, but they also have controls over what can get out. So one of the issues has, and we'll talk about this quite in detail on Friday, when people outside of Palestine want to buy Palestinian goods, they are limited to what the Palestinians are able to get out through Israeli controls. So that, for example, there are a number of churches around the world, but certainly in the U.S., that are selling Palestinian olive oil and Palestinian olive wood carvings and other products that come from the Palestinian producers, but they're always dependent on what Israel lets get out. Interesting story about that is that there are some U.S. controls on that too, U.S. government controls. A couple years ago, a Presbyterian fellow in Brainerd, Minnesota, who brings in Palestinian olive oil for sale in local churches under the heading Import Peace, he had a shipment of olive oil held up at the Minneapolis airport by U.S. Customs agents who said, you cannot have this admitted to the United States because the label on the bottles, there were 1,000 bottles of olive oil, and the label said product of Palestine. And the U.S. government position is there is no such thing as Palestine. There is no Palestinian nation. And he said, well, what do I have to do? And they said, you have to relabel it product of Israel or product. He said, I won't do that. And they said, well, put on product of the West Bank. And he did that.
Well, that's not a country either. So
that is different. That's right. That's right. but there was something about the U.S. Regulations, I guess, on importation that said you cannot use the word Palestine to label it.
Does Georgia permit exportation of West Bank products?
The what?
Jordan. Is that what?
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if they can get it across the Jordan River into Jordan and then leave, that's a way to go. But even that border along the Jordan River is controlled by Israel. You still have to go through Israeli hands, whether you're a human being or a material product. Yeah?
You said that the Palestinians cannot use the roads. How do they keep them off of the roads?
Well, the checkpoints.
I mean, they can just tell if they're Palestinian or
license plates. You have different license plates. The Palestinians have one color plate and the Israelis have another color plate. But even if you weren't in a car that had a particular license plate on, when you try to get onto one of those routes, you're stopped by people at a checkpoint, and they'll ask for papers. Who are you? They'll ask you if you, even visitors, international visitors, have to show a passport to get through checkpoints. You had that experience regularly, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does this whole Israeli statement, I mean, the more you talk about, the more I'm thinking, 65 years ago, the Jews had to wear a yellow star and had to be
show their papers.
Do they not have sympathy for the Palestinians at all? That they are doing the same thing that's done to them?
That's a very appropriate observation. Many have said that, and there are Israelis themselves who say this, history demonstrates repeatedly that an oppressed people, when they have power, become oppressors of others.
It's like abusers, child abuse, people who were abused.
Become abusers.
Become abusers.
Exactly.
Or very often do.
So this is not the first time that's happened.
No, but you think they have a little more sympathy.
Yeah.
So is this the reason, I've heard on the radio that in Israel, they're really making a special, you have to be
in the lineage of Jewish, the ethnic group in America, you can't be a converted Jew. They're saying that now it's going to be harder to become a Jewish citizen, be sort of the ethnic Jewish person.
Yeah, and the tradition among Jews, I think worldwide and for a long time, is you have to have a Jewish mother to be considered ethnically a Jew.
While we were there, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that the Orthodox converts can be Jewish citizens, but the Reformed are suspects, so they're not guaranteed. So they're denominations within this Jewish, but that was the...
And in Israel, I think it's true that the only expression of Judaism that is acceptable is Orthodoxy. Reformed and conservative, which we know in the United States, are not viewed as legitimate. And if you want to get married, you have to be married by an Orthodox rabbi, for example. So,
one of the things, there's an ELCA panel for Lutheran Jewish relations.
Yes.
One of the efforts they're trying to do is encourage people to, in the grassroots in our own communities, relate to the Jewish communities and not demonize them out of that sense that they are now being the evil ones, but how do we work together and try to work on that? There are a lot of Jews who are upset by all the occupation and all the, so if we can dialogue with them and develop relationship with them, and that's the effort,
And do you want to mention the book?
Yes.
I think you mentioned the other night.
Covenantal Conversations book is about that. This particularly helpful chapter by John Stendahl, who's from the
son of the former Swedish American bishop.
Stendahl, but he writes about
he's pastor somewhere in the Boston area, I think.
Right.
An ELCA pastor.
Right. And he in New Andover is where he is. But he writes about the land issues and very sympathetic about the Palestinian issues, but trying to also not demonize the Jews. And
right.
So I think it's a challenge, and I'm pleased with the efforts. Even in the panel, there's a diversity of opinion, about things, and so they're struggling with each other. But the effort to how do we keep dialogue going and not create further us and them kind of thing. And I appreciate what you're doing, and you're making a great contribution through the ELCA.
The book is Covenantal Conversations, and it has both Lutheran and Jewish writers in a kind of dialogue about the Israel-Palestine agenda.
Right. And the most helpful thing, I think, right now for congregations is the DVD that they've developed, where each of these authors, and they're all ELCA professors, either colleges or seminaries, but they do a 10-minute kind of orientation related to their chapter, and then the book just has 8 chapters, so it could make a great adult forum using the DVD and then opening up discussion.
We probably need to break because some are already departing and taking their break, so thank you very much.